Log Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones. Call in and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up and shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
Well, good afternoon, American. And welcome to Southern Sense here on Blog Talk Radio, Kinetic Hi-Fi out of Charleston, South Carolina, and Radio Patriot Radio Network, as well as Tea Party Community. I'm your hostess with the mostest, Annie, the radio chick, and this is a special taped broadcasting for our July 4th Friday broadcast. It is going to be in honor of our nation, its birth, and what brought about the Declaration of Independence. We have a nation that is so unique, so wonderful, and so special that when we think back to how it was formed and why it was formed, we can see why today there are conservative groups and Tea Party groups and independent groups and libertarian groups that are becoming angry with what is going on. And when you think back to our history and what caused the foundation of this nation and what is going on today, you wonder, are we about to enter a second revolution, or are we already in a second revolution? We have to think back. We came a long, hard road. We traveled a very long, hard road before we even came up with the Declaration of Independence. And today, we're starting to go that same road. So today, we're going to talk about the history. What brought about the American Revolution? What caused the writing of the Declaration of Independence? And we'll look back at history and think about what is going on today. So today, as you know, we always dedicate each and every show to a fallen hero, and often fallen heroes. Today's dedication is going to go to our founders of these United States of America, from the statesmen, the publicans, the ministers, the men of commerce and shopkeepers, to those who promoted and nourished the ideals, the values, and principles of our infant nation. We dedicate this show to them, to the men and women who fought for the cause on and off the battlefields. This show is dedicated. Every July 4th at 2 o'clock, church bells should toll. So since it is 2 o'clock, July 4th, we toll the bells to our founding fathers. To our founding fathers, we say thank you. And our dedication will go out to them. Never before in known history of mankind have the subjects of an empire, kingdom, or tribal fiefdom attempted to throw off their tyranny and oppression by asserting their God-given birthrights of self-determination, self-rule, liberty, personal property, and equality under the law. Never before did all of the citizens demand full participation and voice in government. Government was called upon to be limited in scope, purpose, and power, so that no tyrant could seize the reins of power, turning us from full equal citizens into cowed subjects of despotism. To these shores came the men and women who longed for freedom and brought revolutionary ideas of private property ownership, true free market capitalism, limited government, religious freedom, freedom of speech, self-determination, and equality for all under the eyes of law. They dreamed of a just republic of the people, by the people, for the people. We, the people. And look at today, how these very freedoms are being taken from us. Our freedom of speech, where once the black robed regiment would sit in the pulpits in their churches and preach of freedom. They would preach of liberty, of God's given right to man. Today, their voices are held silent. Why? Because of regulations by the Federal Board of Elections, by the IRS. They will lose their tax-exempt status. Dare they speak out against our government? They're being denied their freedom of speech. Day by day, we see the insipid power of a body of government, the IRS, that can step into our very lives and take them from us, deny us our right of liberty, our right of our very property we worked hard to obtain, cow our voices. The NSA is doing the same thing. Bit by bit, our freedoms are being taken away. This is not what our founding fathers fought for. It's what they fought against. And we're allowing them to slip away. Listen to their voices. Hear their ghosts speaking to us. This show is dedicated to those brave men and women who had the courage to speak out and the courage to think. The courage to lay everything on the line. Are we ready now to do the same? Are we willing to pledge our honor, our liberty, and our fortunes to fight to regain those freedoms? This is a special broadcast of Southern Sense. It is one that I'm broadcasting now live today and will be broadcast again on Friday. So if you expect to hear me speaking live on Friday, I will be with family and friends celebrating the Declaration of Independence and the birth of our nation. So if you are joining us, I see you, sweet Sue, listening in. I see you, COG, up in the chat room, and I thank you for joining. Feel free to participate in this special broadcast. And we dedicate, instead of our normal song of Todd Allen Herndon, this is from Operation Americans, and this is a call to all Eagles.
What I tell everyone, I was born by God's dear grace in an extraordinary place, where the stars and stripes and the eagle flies. It's a big old land with countless dreams. Happiness ain't out of reach. Hard work pays off the way it should. Yeah, I've seen enough to know that we've got it good. Where the stars and the stripes and the eagle fly. There's a lady that stands in a harbor for what we play. And if that bothers you, well, that's too bad. But if you got pride and you're proud, you do. Hey, we could use some more like me and you. Where the stars and stripes and the eagles fly. The only place that I prefer to love my wife and raise my kids. Hey, the same way that my daddy did. Where the stars and stripes and the eagles fly. Where the stars and stripes and the eagles fly.
Show today is dedicated to the heroes who pledged their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor for the birth of this nation. It is dedicated to the militias, the citizen soldiers, the Black Robe Regiment that took up arms, as well as the women who not only supported them on the battlefield, but took up their fallen arms and artillery and continued the fight. Their spirit flows in the veins of today's military men, women, and citizen patriots. And to them, We now dedicate this song, My Name is America, by Todd Allen Herndon. No show is ever complete without hearing from Todd. God bless you.
In the grip of oppression, I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. When I'm attacked, I protect and defend, because my name is America. I stand proud and free. My name is America. Don't tread on me. I cannot be broken. I cannot be shamed. Others gave it to me. They believe in the virtues I stand for, my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name,
glad I got a mute knob on my board here. Otherwise, you'd have to listen to me singing along with that song. But Todd Allen Herndon, My Name is America. And as I said, no show is complete without playing that song. All right. We're doing this dedication here to the 4th of July and the Declaration of Independence and our founding fathers who gave us this wonderful, wonderful nation. But July 4th, variously known as the 4th of July and Independence Day. July 4th has been a federal holiday in the United States since 1941. But the tradition of Independence Day celebrations goes back to the 18th century and the American Revolution, which did not happen over just 1 or 2 years, but lasted from 1775 to 1783, 8 long years. In June of 1776, representatives of the 13 colonies then fighting in the revolutionary struggle weighed a resolution that would declare their independence from Great Britain. On July 2nd, the Continental Congress voted in favor of independence, and 2 days later, its delegates adopted the Declaration of Independence, a historic document drafted by Thomas Jefferson. From 1776 until the present day, July 4th has been celebrated as the birth of American independence, with typical festivities ranging from fireworks, parades, and concerts to more casual family gatherings and barbecues, which is where I'll be on July 4th. When the initial battles in the Revolutionary War broke out in April of 1775, few colonists desired complete independence from Great Britain, and those who did were considered radical. Think of today's current Tea Party and other conservative groups being called radical, being called names time and time again. By the middle of the following year, however, many more colonists had come to favor independence, thanks to growing hostility against Britain and the spread of revolutionary sentiments, such as those expressed in Thomas Paine's best-selling pamphlet, Common Sense, published in early 1776. Think also back to just today and yesterday, the public sentiment going against this current administration. And again, I ask, have we begun a second revolution? When on June 7th of 1776, when the Continental Congress met at the Pennsylvania State House, later known as Independence Hall in Philadelphia, the Virginia delegate Richard Henry Lee introduced a motion calling for the colony's independence. Amid heated debate, Congress postponed the vote on Lee's resolution, but appointed a five-man committee, including Thomas Jefferson of Virginia, John Adams of Massachusetts, Roger Sherman of Connecticut, Benjamin Franklin of Pennsylvania, and Robert R. Livingston of New York, to draft a formal statement justifying the break with Britain. Did you know John Adams believed that July 2nd was the correct date on which to celebrate the birth of American independence, and would reportedly turn down invitations to appear at July 4th events in protest? Adams and Thomas Jefferson both died on July 4th, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the adoption of the Declaration of Independence, only hours apart from each other. On July 2nd, the Continental Congress voted in favor of Lee's resolution for independence in a near unanimous vote. The New York delegation abstained, but later voted affirmatively. On that day, John Adams wrote to his wife Abigail that July 2nd, quote, will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival, unquote. And that celebration should include pomp and parade, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from the end of this continent to the other. On July 4th, the Congress formally adopted the Declaration of Independence, which had been written largely by Jefferson. Though the vote for actual independence took place on July 2nd, from then on, the 4th became that day that was celebrated as the birth of American independence. One would think that if you think back to colonial times that led up to the Revolution, all patriots thought alike. In fact, many often cite the views and actions of a specific founder and project it into the image of today's Tea Party conservative groups. Nothing further can be from the truth. And I give you, for that outlook, Mark Levin. And he discussed Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine, two of the men that helped form what we call the United States of America. Their actions, their thoughts, helped bring forth this Declaration of Independence. So this is Mark Levin talking about Thomas Paine and Edmund Burke. And if I can bring this up, and here we go. And I think I need a little
sound
here.
We'll jump into some more things. Thomas Paine and Edmund Burke. Many of you have heard of both of them. Many of you know a whole lot of both of them. Many of you don't know a lot about both of them. Either way, it doesn't really matter. There were huge differences between Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine. Edmund Burke is hated in this country by the left. Hated. And he is considered the father of modern-day conservatism. Thomas Paine is liked by the left in this country, as well as many on the right, and there were many great aspects to the man. But he was also liked, or is, by the left. And the reason is Thomas Paine was considered at the time a radical revolutionary. But the reason Burke did not like Thomas Paine, I've touched on this before, is because Thomas Paine was a revolutionary through and through. Edmund Burke embraced the American Revolution, even though he was an ally of the crown, the British crown, because he thought the American colonies were mistreated by Britain, and he also thought that the kind of ideas that were coming out of the founders were good ideas. Burke supported property rights. He supported natural law. He supported a moral order. He was a man of faith, a man of reason as well. We talked about it the first hour, how he discussed change. Change is constructive, change is destructive. And so Edmund Burke is somebody well worth reading, his writings. Thomas Paine is well worth reading too. Edmund Burke rejected the French Revolution. It's not because he liked the French crown, he didn't. Not particularly, but it was a different kind of revolution. It was a bloodletting revolution. And for years there was a reign of terror, tracking down of parties, killing people, and so forth. Not so in America. And Burke was repulsed by that kind of a revolution, as opposed to the American Revolution. Paine supported both. And so you have a lot of leftists in this country who will quote Thomas Paine, and they won't give Edmund Burke's writings the time of day. I tell you this because if you're a superficial thinker, and you're not, but if you are, and you embrace Thomas Paine and all he stands for, you're embracing some things that we conservatives don't support. And this is important to understand. These are great, great men. But you've got to get beyond that and understand what they stood for. And when it came to the American Revolution, Thomas Paine was a patriot. When it came to the French Revolution, he could not have been more wrong. Edmund Burke, in my view, was right. So I pass that along, because I see somebody commenting about my book, and they don't read his book. Read Thomas Paine's Common Sense. Now, first of all, ladies and gentlemen, you can read Thomas Paine's Common Sense in 1,000 other books. Why do you have to read one or the other? Common Sense is a great essay. I don't compare anything I write to Thomas Paine. You know, these are real standouts. Icons, for better or worse, or for both. But you can read both. And you don't even have to buy them. You can go to the library, presumably, in my case, and check them out and read them. Or share them with somebody else that has them. But I just want you to understand there were differences between the founders and among the founders. Big differences, in many cases. You know, when the Declaration of Independence was drafted by Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson was a deist. He believed in God. He believed in a superior being. But he did not believe in praying to a God. He didn't believe God would actually respond to him. And he had certain other views too. He was not an atheist. He was not a non-believer. He was a deist. Same with Benjamin Franklin. So Thomas Jefferson drafted the Declaration, but that wasn't the draft that was fully adopted in Philadelphia. A lot of it was, but it then went to a committee whose members included John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, and so forth. And they played with it a little bit too. And in the version they played with, God, or references to God, divine providence, creator, there were more of those references in the version that they drafted and then set on to the full body. And the full body made some additional changes to what the committee gave them. And the full body representing all the colonies added yet more references to God in the Declaration of Independence. Each man was his own man. Each man was slightly different than the others. All of them were better than virtually every one of them that represents us today in the United States Congress in the White House. And we have some patriots in Congress, don't get me wrong, but not enough. All of these men stood for the proposition that individual liberty, property rights, limited government in an ordered society, undergirded by a moral order, was the only way in which you could nurture humanity in this society. The people we oppose today do not think this way. They do not think this way. It's government, government, and more government. I have a grievance. I have a pre-existing condition. I want national health care. I can't make my mortgage payment. I want the government to step in and take care of it. I can't pay my credit card off. I want the credit card companies punished, and I want them to take care of it too. I hear pseudo-conservatives say, well, that's good that they stepped in on the credit card. They're missing the entire picture. They don't understand our society, and yet they talk on, and they write books, and they write, and they go on. You have to dismiss them. You have to understand this is clutter. This is noise in the background. So I come back to where I started. Thomas Paine and Edmund Burke. I would encourage you to read whatever you want, whatever those men wrote. And I'd throw in others, Adam Smith. These are not easy reads, but you just take your time and go through it and go back if you need to. I did all this in preparing this book. And as an aside, I should tell you, Adam Smith and Edmund Burke, their lives overlapped. And they were friends. Adam Smith, often viewed as the father of libertarianism, while Edmund Burke viewed as the father of conservatism. But they weren't really that different. They really weren't that different. They both had faith, believed in private property rights. They both believed in limited government and moral order. They both believed in personal responsibilities and personal duties. They had a great deal in common. So I would encourage you to look at Adam Smith, too. All right, every now and then I just want to give a little history and constitutional stuff, and so you understand what a grand nation this is. You already understand it, but that you have confidence and knowledge in that fact. It is such a grand nation, built on such grand, you know, viewpoints and beliefs and values, that I think most of you agree with me. It is so terrible that these traditions and these values be thrown away so easily by one administration and one Congress. I've said it before and I'll say it again. We are on the right side of history.
Better than Mark Levin. I definitely cannot even come close. And he's right. We are on the right side of history. And we have to keep pushing the right side of history. You know, in order to understand what today really is about, you have to understand the events that led up to our independence. You know, in 1776, few people, I'm sorry, 1763, let me get the years correct, few people would have predicted that by 1776, 13 years time span, a revolution would be unfolding in British America. You know, the ingredients of discontent didn't seem to be there. They seemed to be lacking, at least if we look only on the surface. The colonies were not in a state of economic crisis. They weren't, not at all. Quite on the contrary, they were relatively prosperous. They were happy. They were expanding. People were flooding here because they could seek a new and prosperous life. You know, unlike the Irish at the time, you know, groups of American citizens were not clamoring for freedom based upon a national identity. Think about it. Ireland, national identity. Scotland, national identity. You know, King George III at that time was not particularly a despot. You know, surely not to the degree his predecessors were in the previous century. They weren't facing complete tyranny. Furthermore, the colonies were not united. Each colony was proudly independent with its own identity. You know, Benjamin Franklin discovered this quite clearly when he tried to devise what was called the Albany Plan of Union in 1754. And this was during the French and Indian War. He tried to unite the colonies to get them to fight together. He had this slogan he used for the Albany Plan called Join or Die. Do you remember that banner of the snake cut up into 13 portions? And underneath it, it was said, join or die. A lot of people still, you know, wave that banner. That was Benjamin Franklin. His plan was soundly defeated, so the colonies were not united. How then, in just a few short years, just 13 years, did everything change? What happened to make the American colonists, most of whom thought themselves as English subjects, want to break the ties that bound them to their forebears? What forces led the men and women in 13 different colonies to set aside their differences and unanimously declare their independence? Well, a lot happened. A lot of things happened between the years of 1763 and 1776. To start off with, the colonies felt they were unfairly taxed. Now, you got to remember, at the height of this, they were being taxed at only 2%. Have you sat down today and looked at how much of your money is being taxed? Everywhere you turn, you face a tax. An income tax, a sales tax, a gas tax, a utility tax. A tax on every single thing you do. Can you name one thing in your life that is not taxed somewhere along the way? And if you say, oh, well, the guy that cuts my lawn, I'm not taxed by him. Wrong. You're wrong right there. When you pay for that service, you are also paying for the taxes that person is giving you. The gasoline tax, his income tax, the preparation for his income tax, the purchase of the equipment, the tax. You're still paying for taxes, even though you may not see it directly coming out of your wallet, with the bottom line saying subtotal tax along the way, every inch of the way. So if you think that only 2% sales tax was enough to cause the American Revolution, think about the taxes you're paying today. And is that not something to rise up about? I'm not talking about an armed revolution. I'm talking about a societal revolution. I'm talking about getting a hold of your congressman, getting a hold of your senator, and telling them, stop. It's got to stop now. It's too much. Government is too big. Government is too oppressive. They did this in 1776. Why can't we do that today? Why cannot we seek redress from our government? Why aren't we doing that? Where are the voices? Where is your voice? One thing for me to get to rant and rave here on the radio, but I'll tell you this. I do go to my county council meetings. I do put my voice in the newspaper. I do contact my elected officials, be they the local councilman, all the way up to standing toe-to-toe, nose-to-nose with Senator Lindsey Graham. I'm not afraid to do it. If I can do it, one person, think about what would happen if you did it and you challenged your neighbor or a member of your family to do it. Make it not just one voice. Make it a united voice. This is how the colonists did it. They finally found something to unite against, and they used their voice in unison. And when their voices were no longer heard and the oppression increased, then they saw the need to open revolt. We're not there. We are a long way to go. So trust me, I'm not talking about an open armed revolt. I'm talking about a vote, a revolt of pen and paper and voice. Find your voice. Put it to good use. Well, for the most part, the British thought the colonists were unwilling to pay their fair share for the administration of the empire. After all the citizens residing in England paid more in taxes than was asked of any American during the entire time of the entire crisis. But this wasn't the first time the American colonists found them in dispute with the Great Britain. This time, the first time, cooler heads did prevail. They sought action by one side, brought a strong response. They did petition Parliament. They did petition the king. It created, though, a sharp division among the English people, those that sided with the American colonists, saying you're placing undue burdens on them, and those who said those upstarts need to be put back under our thumb. Over time, though, the geographic distance between England and the colonies became more and more noticeable. It took time for England to respond to the colonial provocations and to administer to the settled areas of America. Furthermore, some of them now even questioned how it could be that a tiny island nation could contain and rule the entire American continent. Before long, the point of no return was going to be reached. Between 1763 and 1775, this is what happened. The proclamation of 1763, it was a royal proclamation. It prohibited any English settlement west of the Appalachian Mountains and required those already settled in those regions to return east in an attempt to ease tensions with the Native Americans. Now, you got to understand what this is. You got to remember that the French and Indian War had just ended. And in the Treaty of Paris, the ceded territory known as Ohio Valley, which was marked by the Appalachian Mountains in the east and the Mississippi River in the west, it was ceded to us. But the British found it very, very hard to rule on both sides of the mountains. So despite this acquisition of this large piece of land, the British tried to discourage American colonists from settling in it. They already had difficulty administering in the settled areas east of the Appalachians. Americans moving west could stretch British administrative resources very, very thin. Furthermore, just because the French government yielded this territory to Britain, it did not mean that the Ohio Valley French inhabitants would give up their claims to land or trade routes. You know, think of it this. Here, you fought for this land. You fought for these trade routes. This was your life. This was everything you had. And all of a sudden, your government's saying, oh, you got to give it up. The British now own it. Wouldn't you be pissed off and wouldn't you be willing to fight for it? And if you were a British settler who carved out a piece of land or a trade route, and this was your life, suddenly the British government said, well, it's taking us too much money and too much manpower to administrate this, so we're just going to leave it as virgin land. So you've got to move back on the other side of the mountains, give everything up. Would you do it? I hope not. Well, they didn't want to do it either. You know, the scattered pockets of French settlers made the British fearful of another war. The war had dragged on long enough, the French and Indian War, and the British public was weary of footing that bill. Moreover, the Native Americans who had allied themselves with the French during the Seven Years' War continued to fight even after the peace treaty had been reached. Potomac's rebellion continued after the imperial powers achieved ceasefire. So for to them, the war never ended. The peace treaty between the two white men meant nothing to them. And rightly so. This was their land to begin with. The last thing the British government wanted were hordes of American colonists crossing the Appalachians, fueling the French and Native American resentment. The solution seemed simple. The Royal Proclamation of 1763 was issued, which declared the boundaries of settlement for inhabitants of 13 colonies to be Appalachia. But what seemed simple to the British was not acceptable to the colonial subjects. This remedy did not address some concerns vitally important to the colonies. Colonial blood had been shed to fight the French and Indians, not to cede land to them. What was to be said for American colonists who already settled in the West? What was to be said for them? In addition, the colonies themselves had already begun to set their sights on expanding their western boundaries. Such plans sometimes even causing tension among the colonies. Now, you think about this attempt to control the population and where they lived. And think to today. What comes to your mind? Two words. Agenda 21. Is that not happening today? Aren't we being forced out of rural areas because they want us to ride the bicycles around the cities and take their buses around the cities? Aren't they forcing us to buy cars that do not work in rural areas? Can you imagine a farmer trying to use an electric vehicle to plow his lands or haul his loads? They can't handle that capacity at this time. But still, they're trying to shame us into buying these little tin cans. And by the way, fatalities in those little toy vehicles are far higher than in my SUV. So think about that. Do they really care about us? Or are they thinking about how they can control us? Because if you have an electric car, you're limited to wherever that grid is, where you can plug your car in and recharge it. Whereas if you have a gasoline car, you can take a can of gasoline, put it in the back of your car, and keep on going if there isn't even a gas station nearby. Think about the freedom they're trying to take away from you. Think about Agenda 21. This mindset has not gone away. It was there in colonial times, and it's here today. You know, the colonies, our American forebears, they saw that this law was observed with the same reverence that they observed the mercantile laws. There was so much bootlegging and black market going on because of the oppressive trade laws. So they treated it the same way, just something else that they should find a way to get around. Scores of wagons headed westward. Go west, young man, go west. How could the British possibly enforce this decree? It was impossible. The proclamation of 1763 merely became a part of the long list of events which in the interest and intent of actions of one side was misunderstood and disregarded by the other. It was the first salvo in the American Revolution. In 1764, the Sugar Act was passed. And actually the offset, it was the sugar tax was meant to offset the war debt, the French and Indian War. And it was also supposed to pay for the expense of running the colonies and the newly acquired territories. This tax increased the duties on imported sugars and other items such as textile, coffee, wines, indigo, which is a dye. It doubled the duties. Catch this. It doubled the duties on foreign goods reshipped from England to the colonies, and also forbid the import of foreign rum and French wines. So in other words, anything being shipped into the colonies had to go through England first so the taxes can be imposed upon it, rather than being shipped directly from where they came, whether it be Spain, France, Holland. Instead of being shipped directly from there and the duties imposed upon them once they came onto the American soil, they had to go to England first to be taxed and then come to the United States or the colonies and be taxed again. It greatly increased the cost, because imagine the cost of having to ship to England first, go through that process, and then be shipped here. So the price of everything began to skyrocket. In 1764, the English Parliament then passed a measure to reorganize American customs system to better be enforced by the British trade laws. What they did was they established their office and the courts in Halifax, Nova Scotia. It would have jurisdiction over all of the colonies in trade. So in other words, if you had a grievance, there wasn't a jurisdictional court nearby. There wasn't one, say, in Philadelphia or New York or in Charleston. You had to go all the way up to Nova Scotia, Canada, to file your grievance. And that was a huge, huge imposition. The distance to travel and the ability to travel that far. It's not like today you can hop on a plane and just take off and go there and be there within a matter of a couple of hours. So they did it deliberately to further harass the colonists. In 1764, the Currency Act was enacted. It prohibited the colonists from using any legal tender paper money. This threatened to destabilize the entire colonial economy, both of the industrial North and the agricultural South. And there, the colonists began to unite. So imagine, there was no money that you could use except for British currency. And it was tightly held. So in other words, if the colonists wanted to purchase anything, they had to find some way in which they could obtain British currency, because the currency they were using within the colonies was no longer valid or accepted. So payment of debts was impossible. How could you purchase or pay a debt if you did not physically hold that currency in your hand? And they did it to weaken the colonists. Well, I want to remind you, you're listening here to Southern Sense, and this is a special broadcast which will be uploaded to Friday's normal place, because tomorrow I do have something to do. So you are listening to Southern Sense here on Blog Talk Radio, as well as Kinetic Hi-Fi out of Charleston, South Carolina, TeaPartyCommunity.com, and Patriot Radio Network. And again, I remind you, if you're pissed off with Facebook, check out TeaPartyCommunity.com. So I welcome those that are listening in on the phone and in the chat room. Cog and Vorp, welcome aboard. And as we do this show completely dedicated to our founding fathers and the Declaration of Independence, and we go over the events that lead up to our American Revolution. And I'm trying to see where I left off. All right, here we're talking about some of the things that led off. We talked about the Sugar Act and the Currency Act. And on the Currency Act, I have a notation here. All right, the colonies were plagued by a shortage of legal British currency. To offset that problem, they began printing their own bills of credit. These notes were not regulated, not backed by hard silver or gold currency, and their use and value varied depending upon where they were issued. The result was confusion, compounded by the fear due to erratic colonial economy. To assuage the anxious British merchant creditors, the Parliament passed the Currency Act on September 1, 1764. Essentially, the Currency Act gave Parliament control of the colonial currency system. It abolished all the bills of credit altogether and put the colonists at further economic disadvantage in their trade relations with British merchants. Well, imagine that this person owed you all this money, then all of a sudden, in one fell swoop, just like our current government does now, think of it the same way. The very same thing that was happening in 1763 is happening today. Student loans, people that go underwater with their mortgages, all wiped out. The debt completely forgiven, and the creditor left holding the bag. And here, their business is based upon recouping that debt and then making a profit above it called interest. But imagine now, as it was then, what is happening. Just think about that. How our economy has been tossed into turmoil. When our housing market tanked, how many people were hurt? And think about it happened in 1763. It's happening today. Again, is this not a cause for a second revolution? And again, I remind you, I am not advocating for a violent revolution. I am advocating for a social revolution, a revolution of voices, a revolution of protests, of speaking out and getting your voice heard. And Vorp says, as a former landlord, I've been left holding the bag before. And I can absolutely sympathize with that, Vorp, because we've had it happen. I manage a piece of property for my parents, or I should say now my mother. My father recently passed. And I would say out of the last five tenants, four of us left us high and dry. And that's not a good record. That is not a good record at all. And for some reason, they feel as if they're entitled to do that, to walk out and leave you with not just a back rent, but with an electric bill, a water bill. And you can be out thousands upon thousands of dollars. I'm not rich. I mean, if I've got a couple hundred dollars in the bank, I consider myself wealthy at the moment. But having someone to leave me holding a huge, huge electric bill, and here you say, oh, no, I'm paying it, And then the electricity gets turned off. And then it goes on your credit, not their credit. They walk away. They're laughing. They're getting welfare. They're getting public assistance. All this money they're getting food stamps. So where's that money go? It goes into the next bottle of booze. It goes into the next pound of pot. It goes up their nose, in their arm. It doesn't go. I mean, public welfare does not work, folks. Because the reason it doesn't work is because people abuse the system. And then the politicians use it as to drive a wedge. Drive a wedge between those of us that believe in the American system of hard work and honesty and those that want the handout, that free phone, that mortgage paid for them, that college tuition paid for them. They feel that we owe them. I beg to differ. They owe us. And it's time we start to ask them to pay us back. It is time for those freeloaders to get off their butts and repay the society that has been giving them that free ride. This is what happened in colonial times. The American colonists knew they were being taken for a ride. The same thing is happening today. What brought us to the Declaration of Independence, our Constitution, to the Revolutionary War, is happening today. And I'm looking at what Vorp is writing, and he says, I had a judge give a woman 9 months to leave the property, and he had to pay the utilities the whole time. She had nine children. He gave her 1 month per child to find a new home. He said it was a raw deal. And if I didn't pay for her, then the city would have to. And that's what's happening. That is exactly what happens. You know, there was a couple that we had as tenants, and I'm not using any names because there could be legal ramifications. And they decided to get married. So a bunch of us got together. We all paid out of our pocket for her flowers, for the food, for the reception, and on down the line, for the dress. I was out a couple hundred dollars. I didn't ask for it back. For me, it was a wedding gift for them. But she asked to use my credit I had with one company so that she could purchase the wedding bands. I said, fine, as long as you make sure you give me the monthly payments. It's this much over this many months. I never saw a penny. So what I did, thinking I did her a favor, I ended up several hundred dollars out for the wedding bands. And they were living with us, not with us, but in that property that we rented out. And I got maybe out of the year they were there, 3 months worth of rent. So I was out 9 months worth of rent. I was out the utility bills because they were under my name. And because they kept on crying poverty and he wasn't working and she wasn't working, they were getting public assistance. They were getting housing assistance. They were getting assistance for food. He was getting assistance for education. So he was going to school, to the local college, just long enough to get these checks, these monthly checks. Plus, he was getting some sort of a disability check. So we're getting all of this public assistance. And out of all of that, I was out, I think we came up to a total of about maybe $3,000. And boy, was I a sucker. I got taken as a sucker big time. And worst part about it is, those that know me know that I enjoy canning my own food, you know, soups and sauces and pickles and jams and things like that. And I'm pretty damn good at it. And I would bring over food. And when they moved out, I found these jars tossed over a fence, not in our yard, but in the neighbor's yard, never opened. It was a joke to them. That's what public assistance does. And Warp is right. There's public opinion that landlords are wealthy slumlords that need to be punished. Well, that is what the left wants everyone to think. And we've got to push back at it. And that's why this is the time for a second revolution, a revolution of thought, a revolution of social action, a revolution of getting our voice out there and heard and countering their arguments. When just a couple weeks back, I stood before the county council fighting a sales tax increase. And I turned around and I told them, you know, 70% of the people in this county pay the sales tax. Only 30% comes from tourism. Only 30%. And you are using the argument that tourism will pay the majority of this tax. That's wrong. By the Chamber of Commerce's own figures on their website, 70% comes from the local people. And of 70% of those people, majority of them live at or below the poverty level. They're the ones that you're going to hurt. The day after Thanksgiving, my husband and I joined our church in a public park, handing out food. And I saw people come there, children come there, that didn't own a coat. It was 30 degrees outside. I was freezing in my parka. And these kids are walking up in T-shirts because they didn't own a coat. They didn't own a sweater. And you're asking them to pay that extra tax. This is how we have to frame the argument. They aim for the heart. Let's aim back. Because those of us that do volunteer our time, that do go out there and work with the homeless and the poor, how many of them out there are liberals working those soup kitchens? You don't find many of them. How many of them are conservatives and libertarians and Republicans? The vast majority. They're good Christians. And yet Christians are derided. Conservatives are derided. Libertarians are derided. And now the Republicans have shot themselves in the foot with what went on with Thad Cochran in Mississippi. This is why we need the revolution. This is why we need to take that Republican Party back. And I'm telling you, folks, this Friday, there is going to be an announcement that's going to break across the news waves. This Friday, I'm thinking it's going to be somewhere around 12 noon. There's going to be a major news announcement coming out of the great state of South Carolina. Lindsey Graham is not going to be so secure in his run for re-election. Mark my words. I've got inside knowledge, and I've spoken with this individual, and he will be coming on this show very soon. Matter of fact, I sent him a text message just a couple of hours ago asking him to come on next week's show. I will follow up with a phone call and see if I can get him on for the beginning of Tuesday's show. This individual is going to be announcing his run and challenge for the seat of Senate here out of the state of South Carolina. He will be challenging Lindsey Graham, and you will hear it, and you're hearing the four announcement. I mentioned it before. It will happen this Friday, and it will come out of Greenville, South Carolina. It will be coming from an event called Red, White, and Blue for a 4th of July celebration. It will come out tomorrow. The revolution has started. This is not the first shot across the bow, but this is now one of many. And if they keep it up, we will use our voices. We will use our pens. We will use public opinion. And we're going after them. What happened in 1763 to 1776 is happening today. And that's why I'm doing this special broadcast. And that's why this is going to be uploaded and will be replayed tomorrow at our normal showtime. This message has to get out. We think of the Declaration of Independence and the Revolutionary War as just something in history. History repeats itself, folks. History does repeat itself. And it's time we recognize that. It's time that we stand up. And that is what we need to do. We need to stand up. And in that, we give you Jeremy Dodge.
To the flag of
America, the United States of America, and the Universal Public Liberty and Justice for All. Somebody's gotta stand up.
Jeremy Dodge, stand-up. If anyone wonders how I managed to play some clips that you really cannot download, that's the beauty of a mixer board, because I work, whenever I do the broadcast, with two different computers, and I've got one hooked up where if I see a clip I like, I end up emailing it to myself, and then I just go into my email, pull the clip up, and then I can play it through the board. That's how I'm able to do it. So don't think I'm some sort of major computer genius. I'm not, but I hope everyone enjoyed that. You know, there's so much to compare to what happened between 1763 and 1776 to what is happening today. And you think about all the intrusions we have in our daily lives. You know, I was talking about some of the acts that went on, such as the Sugar Act, the Stamp Act. We also could be talking about the Quartering Act. We've got these illegal immigrants flowing over the border. And what is happening? Something very, very similar to what happened back between 1763 and 1776, the Quartering Act, where the British troops were going into private homes and taverns and insisting on being housed there. Now, we've got these illegal immigrants now being forced into our communities, and we are being forced to house them and feed them. This is the very same thing that happened in colonial times. We, our predecessors, our forebears, were being forced to house and clothe their own enemy. And are not illegal aliens now our enemy? Are not they not sucking our system dry? They're coming over the border, and they're walking up to border agents, no longer sneaking across. They're just blatantly coming across. Whether or not they're on water skis, I mean, what are these little ski-doos or whatever they call those things? They're just blatantly walking across the border, walking up to an INS agent and saying, I'm seeking asylum because I came from a communist and socialist country. I'm fleeing. And then we have to take them in. They're coming in, the majority of them from Honduras, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Venezuela. Not just Mexico anymore. It's not solely limited. But what we're also getting is a mixture of terrorists. They're coming over from Yemen, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Syria. The terrorists are in cahoots with the drug cartels. The drug cartels take them in, teach them the dialect, the local customs, how to dress, how to act, and say that when you go over the border, say you're from Honduras, say that you're from Guatemala, speak perfect Spanish in that dialect, and they will believe you. You don't need papers. You don't need anything. Walk up to the nearest INS agent, and they will put you on a bus. They will take you to a hospital, have you physically checked out. And if there is something wrong with you, they will pay for your dental as well as your medical. They'll get you healthy. They'll put you on another bus, take you to another city further in the United States. And they're coming here to South Carolina. They're coming here to Georgia. They're not just in Arizona. They're going up to Vermont. They're going up to New Hampshire. They're going up to Massachusetts. They're being shipped out to all 50 states. They are not being given a summons and told you must report to court within 2 weeks. They're told when you get off that bus in that town and find a place to live, go back to the local immigration office, give them your address, and we will mail the summons to you. What the? Flying, you know what I want to say. What WTF in capital letters? Telling them, find yourself a place to live, then tell us where it is so we can mail you the summons and keep track of you. Isn't that bass-ackward? Folks, what happened in 1763 to 1776 is nothing compared to what is happening today. If ever there was a cause for a second revolution, a social revolution. Now, I'm not talking about taking up arms and going and knocking over the nearest police station. I am talking about knocking on the door of your elected officials and say, this has got to stop. This has got to stop drawing the very fabric that was set, the very foundation of this building we call the United States. You are tearing the walls down and you are smashing the concrete foundation, the foundation of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. You're not taking a sledgehammer. You're taking a wrecking ball chain to it. And it starts with the office of the president all the way on down, folks, all the way on down to your local council, all the way on down. Back in 1775, something new was happening. The colonists, who always proclaimed themselves as loyal British subjects, calling themselves Americans. What do we call ourselves now? Because what they called American is not American today. The traditional values and social political bonds that was the shared heritage of the English was diverging. Americans bristled at the bonds of a subject. They bristled at the very bonds imposed upon them. They sought freedoms and rights that were totally alien and new. Well, folks, we were born now into these freedoms and these rights, and we're giving them up. That's not what these United States are about. That's not what it's about at all. What we need to do is go back to that Declaration of Independence and to remember what it stood for, to remember why it came about. We need to reclaim it.
Neither aiming at originality of principle or sentiment, nor yet copied from any particular previous writing, it was intended to be an expression of the American mind, and to give to that expression the proper tone and spirit called for the occasion.
Midst of revolution, the most complete, unexpected, and remarkable of any in the history of the world.
Every post and every day rolls in upon us independence like a torrent.
Our obligations to our country never cease, but with our lives.
We must all hang together, or most assuredly, we shall all hang separately.
Why is it we hesitate? For God's sake, let us come to the final separation. The birthday of the new world is at hand. The tree of liberty is watered with the blood of patriots and tyrants both.
When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another.
And to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them.
A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
That they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights.
Among these are life,
liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed.
That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends,
it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government.
Laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form.
to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that government long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable
than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed.
But when a long train of abuses and usurpation, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism,
it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security.
Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies.
And such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government.
We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America,
in General Congress, assembled,
appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies,
solemnly publish and declare.
That these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states.
That they are absolved from the allegiance to the British Crown.
And that all political connections between them and the state of Great Britain
is and ought to be totally dissolved.
And as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce.
And to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do.
And for the support of this declaration,
with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence,
we mutually pledge to each other our lives,
our fortunes,
and our sacred honor.
Why so large, Mr. Hancock?
So that Fat George can read it all the way from London without using his spectacles.
On this day, we light a great torch of freedom.
Huzzah!
Our citizenship in the United States is our national character. Our citizenship in any particular state is only our local distinction.
By the latter, we are known at home. By the former, to the world, our great title is America.
Is that not awesome? Is that not bringing to mind why we are Americans? Is that not a reason to take our country back? Is that not the cause that we should be fighting for? Don't sit at home silently and let government take our lives from us. Take pen to paper and write an editorial. Take pen to paper and write your congressman and your senator. Pick up that phone and call them. Write the White House. Don't be afraid. I have no shame. I post all the time. Post it up on social networks so the word gets out. Don't be afraid to speak out. And when you go in public, don't duck from conversations that center on politics. Stand your ground. I have no qualms in entering a conversation with a progressive. I tell a story often about sitting on a bar stool next to a guy who was a self-proclaimed liberal. And then when we discuss the issues, I always say, look, we are really not that far apart. And he has to admit that we are not. When you think of issues and you bring them back to the core constitutional principles, to core moral values, you will find that 99% of the Americans here really do agree with us. It's 1% that is controlling the conversation. 1% controls the conversation. 10% mimic them because They are low information individuals. All they know is how to parrot something someone else tells them. And when they start parroting it, start tearing their argument apart. Put the holes in it. Shoot it apart. But the trick is, you do it in a calm fashion. You don't argue. You don't name call. That's where you lose. Remember the Herman Cain acronym, SIN, S-I-N? When you do debate someone on the other side, and they truly are a liberal and progressive, they will do three things when they find out they are losing the conversation. The first one is the letter S. When they find they're losing the conversation and they're not getting their point, they switch the subject. Pull them back on that subject. Pull them back onto the main core of your debate. Don't let them switch it. Keep yanking them back. Oh, we're talking about birth control and this recent court case, the Supreme Court, and they're not letting women have contraception. And why? That's not what the argument was. The argument was about religious freedom. And out of the 20 contraceptions that they were fighting for, they only picked out four. And they weren't contraceptives. They were abortion medications. So Hobby Lobby wasn't saying we will not provide contraception. They were saying we will not provide abortions. The four medications were abortion medications. It was to induce the abortion of a fetus chemically, not to prevent the creation of a fetus, but to abort one. So bring their argument back to what the real truth and the heart of the matter is. Once they switch the subject and they find they're still not winning, then they will ignore the facts. And when they ignore the facts, you know the very next thing, when you keep on turning around and punching holes in their poor facts or their non-facts, they will then call you name call. And 9 times out of 10, somewhere along that way in the name calling, they will use Nazi, racist, and Hitler. Then you know you won the debate. And you tell them that. You laugh. Laugh at them. I knew I was winning the debate because first you did three things. You sinned. S-I-N. You switched the subject. You ignored the fact. And now because you can't win, you name call. Well, I am glad I will not stoop to your level and name call. But I know you lost the argument. And I'm happy in the fact that you know you lost the argument. And walk away. You will feel like $1 million, and they will feel like a piece of crap. That's how you do it. Tear them apart. Tear those arguments apart. This is what our founding fathers did. You know, the American Revolution, which is what we're comparing, the events of 1763 to 1776 to what is happening today, the American Revolution was simply not a series of impersonal events. Men and women made fateful, often difficult decisions that led to the Great Clash. Although patriots could be found in any of the 13 colonies, none were more numerous than in the city of Boston. And ask yourself why, and here's why. Perhaps the prevalence of shipping in Boston made Bostonians especially resent the restrictions on trade. Remember the Stamp Act, the Sugar Act, what was the other one I was talking about with the increase in the tariffs? All that, all those things affected commerce and it affected the economy. So every single colonial individual was affected. You know, maybe the legacy of religious quarrels with the Church of England made Bostonians more rebellious. It's a long history of town meetings and self-rule may have led New Englanders to be wary of royal authority. And this is something also that the left fears, because when we do have the town halls, they're finding that there's more people on the right than on the left. Think back to that meeting, I believe it was up in Chicago earlier this year or late last year, with the Right Reverend Al Sharpton, and he tried to bring that message. And the town hall that was held, the majority of people there were black. And they were the people that supported him in the past. And when he got to that town hall, boy, did they whip him a new one. And that's it's up on YouTube. Just Google Chicago Town Hall, Reverend Sharpton, and I'm sure you will find that all over the place. They really did rip them a brand new one, and good for them. They're afraid of those town halls. And this is what the early colonies had. They had those town halls. And because of them, they were able to share ideas. And we have to go back to that. Hold more town halls. Hold them accountable. Get those elected officials to show up and answer for their actions. So not only just call and write them, form the town hall, invite them there, and challenge them on their stances. Don't let it go. If you found they did a vote that you do not agree with, call them on the carpet. Don't be afraid. This is the start of our second revolution. This is where we start, holding our elected officials and our government officials accountable. Well, maybe perhaps it was a combination of all these things and other factors that led the city of Boston to being the leading voice against British authority. It was, after all, the Boston Massacre and the Boston Tea Party. Furthermore, fierce patriots such as James Otis, Samuel Adams, John Hancock, and Paul Revere were all citizens of one great city, Boston. James Otis was quick-tempered. He was the most aggressive opponent of British taxation policies. As early as 1761, British merchants hired him to provide legal defense against British search warrants. Remember again, our Constitution guaranteeing us against unwarranted search and seizures. Well, that's happening today. The IRS has carte blanche for unwarranted search and seizure. The NSA is today performing unwarranted searches and seizures of your cell phone, your computers, your other communications. Ladies and gentlemen, this is what our founding fathers tried to prevent, and we've allowed it to happen, and we've got to speak out against it. Well, James Otis, getting back to him, he had a widely distributed pamphlet called The Rights of the British Colonists Asserted and Proved. It was one of the first legal criticisms of Parliament's taxation policies. A large man with a large heart for British liberties, he was perceived by many in London to be the center of treasonous American activity. But Otis also saw himself as fiercely loyal to the English Constitution. Once he stormed into the British Royal Coffee House to face drawn swords. Because of his loyalty had been called into question, violence ensued. Otis was so severely beaten that he never recovered. The wounds he received made him somewhat of a martyr around Boston. Otis was never the same mentally after the severe beatings. Friends and admirers commented that his diminished verbal capacities. Of Otis, John Adams wrote, quote, "In short, I never saw such an object of admiration, reverence, contempt, and compassion all at once as this. I fear, I tremble, I mourn for the man and his country. Many others mourn over him with tears in their eyes. Poor Otis." In May 1782, Otis was killed after being struck by a bolt of lightning. Samuel Adams perhaps was the furious supporter of American liberty in the 13 colonies. His mind drew a sharp distinction between the evils of the British Empire and simple American life. His skills as a political organizer, there were political organizers even back then, drove the colonies towards declaring independence. Adams chaired the Boston town meeting that preceded the infamous Tea Party. Rather unsuccessful in a series of pursuits prior to the revolution, he found his calling in organizing and rabble-rousing. He served as an active member of the Sons of Liberty and creator of the first significant committee of correspondence. As the revolutionary approached, the cries for Adams had grew louder and louder in the streets of London. Now, think of this. They didn't have Twitter. They didn't have Facebook. They didn't have Blog Talk Radio. But what they did have was the power of the pen. And by doing these circles of correspondence, they were able to circulate and gather and do what we now, taking them a couple of weeks, and for us, it takes 140 characters or less, but they did what we are doing today. What happened then is happening now, folks. So when we celebrate Independence Day tomorrow, when we celebrate July 4th, think about what they had to go through to achieve their goals and the creation of this nation, and how we can still bring it back to their founding principles. We have the power. We have the ability. And I'm telling you, this is the start of a peaceful second revolution. We will do it by word of mouth. We will do it by pen. We will do it by keystroke. But we must, and we will do it. We will do it on the voting booth this coming November. And we have to take back that Senate. And after that, set our eyes on the White House and bring this country back to a constitutional democratic republic. You know, Samuel Adams wrote in a letter to Arthur Lee, "The destruction of the T is the pretense for the unprecedented severity shown to the town of Boston, but the real cause is the opposition to tyranny, for which the people of that town have always made themselves remarkable, and for which I think this country is much obliged to them. They are suffering the vengeance of administration in the common cause of America." Our tea parties are exactly for this, protesting tyranny, protesting the overreach of government. This broadcast is the same thing, preaching against tyranny and the overreach of government. John Adams, with Samuel Adams' second cousin, was no less a patriot. His early fame as the defense attorney for the British soldiers in the trial that followed the Boston Massacre cannot be taken in isolation. Think back to our Constitution and the right to a trial by a jury of your peers. That was the idea of John Adams. That is why, even though he was a fierce American patriot, he chose to uphold those rights that he believed those men deserved, a right for a trial by jury. And though he was criticized for defending the enemy, what he did instead was defend a basic American right for a fair trial. And think about how we enjoy that. How it's one of the few things that has not been infringed yet. It's not far behind. It is one of the few things. I saw a movie with my husband last night, Charles Laughton and Maureen O'Hara. It was called This Is My Land. And it was based upon a book written about the invasion of this town in Poland by the Nazis and how they did it and how they restricted free speech and commerce and everything else. The last thing they could not touch, the last thing they were unable to touch, but they finally did, was the right to an open and fair trial. And Charles Laughton used that right in his trial to speak out against the tyranny. He was falsely accused of murder, a murder he did not commit. Turned out to have been a suicide and ruled finally as a suicide. But he used that time, knowing full well they were going to issue the verdict, not guilty. But in his soliloquy, he states, "Even though I know you will find me not guilty and know it was a suicide, I am using this time to speak out. I know by doing so, I have signed my death warrant. Because when I walk out of here, I will be arrested again and brought before a firing squad." And he used that time to speak out against the Nazis. And that's exactly what happened. He no sooner walked out of court a free man and began to openly teach his students the very books that the Nazis wanted burned. And for that, he was dragged out of his classroom and shot for exercising his free speech. Think about this. Every now and then, you're going to find a library is going to be pulling books off the shelf, saying they should be banned. That happens today. That happens in the town that you live in. This is the tyranny coming back upon us. This is what we need to speak out against. This is what our founding fathers had us fight for. And I will give you the very words of Patrick Henry himself. And if I can bring this all the way back to the beginning, and just bear with me as I try to get this all the way back around, having a little bit of a problem getting this to start at the very beginning. And let's see if this will do it. And here we go.
Something that could be done to avert the storm that is now coming on. We have petitioned. We have remonstrated. We have supplicated. We have prostrated ourselves before the throne and implored its interposition to arrest the tyrannical hands of the ministry and parliament. Our petitions have been slighted. Our remonstrances have produced additional violence and insults. Our supplications have been disregarded, and we have been spurned with contempt from the foot of the throne. In vain, after these things, may we indulge the fond hope of peace and reconciliation. There is no longer any room for peace. If we wish to be free, if we mean to hold inviolate those inestimable privileges for which we have been so long contending, if we mean not basely to abandon the noble struggle in which we have been so long engaged and which we have pledged ourselves never to abandon until the glorious object of our contest shall be obtained, we must fight. I repeat it, sir. We must fight. An appeal to arms and to the God of hosts is all that is left us. They say, sir, that we are weak and able to cope with so formidable an adversary. But when shall we be stronger? Will it be the next week or the next year? Will it be when we are totally disarmed and a British guard shall be stationed in every house? Shall we acquire the means of effectual resistance by lying supinely on our backs and hugging the delusive phantom of hope until our enemy shall have bound us hand and foot? Sir, we are not weak. If we make a proper use of those means which the God of nature hath placed in our power. The millions of people armed in the holy cause of liberty and in such a country as that which we possess are invincible by any force which our enemy can send against us. Besides, sir, we shall not fight our battles alone. There is a just God who presides over the destinies of nations and who will raise up friends to fight our battles before us. The battle, sir, is not to the strong alone. It is to the vigilant, the active, the brave. Besides, sir, we have no election. If we were base enough to desire it, it is now too late to retire from the contest. There is no retreat but in submission and slavery. Our chains are forged. Their clanking may be heard on the plains of Boston. The war is inevitable, and let it come. I repeat it, sir, let it come. It is in vain, sir, to extenuate the matter. Gentlemen may cry, peace, peace. There is no peace. The war is actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren are already in the field. Why stand we here idle? What is it the gentlemen wish? What would they have? Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God! I know not what course others may take, but as for me, Give me liberty or give me death.
Give me liberty or give me death. How many people are willing to say that today? How many people are out there willing to say it today? You know, I was talking about these five gentlemen from Boston that were a central part of our American Revolution, and one of them was John Hancock. He was the man with that famous signature. He was also a Bostonian. Hancock earned the early ire of British officials as a major smuggler. Remember I told you about all these acts that put a huge quash on colonial commerce. The seizure of one of his ships brought a response from the Bostonians that led directly to the British occupation in 1768. Later, Hancock and Samuel were the two agitators whose arrest was ordered by General Gage after the battles of Lexington and Concord. As a man of great wealth, he had much to lose by resisting Britain. Nevertheless, he did not bend. Had he been arrested, it would have definitely meant his death. Paul Revere was the last one. He didn't come from the same social class as the other gentleman I mentioned. He was a silversmith. He was a man of humble means like you and me. But his attitudes about Britain were anything but humble. His famous midnight ride that warned the advancing British troops was only one of his revolutionary actions. He was also an illustrator whose image of the Boston Massacre became iconic. Now remember, he did not ride alone. Another gentleman by the last name of Dawes also rode. And Paul Revere later on wrote of his account in his own words. I set off. It was about 11 o'clock. The moon shone bright. I had got almost over Charleston Common towards Cambridge when I saw two officers on horseback standing under the shade of a tree in a narrow part of the road. I was near enough to see their holsters and cockades. One of them started his horse towards me, the other up the road, as I was supposed to head me off, should I escape the first. I turned my horses short about and rode upon a full gallop for Mystic Road. He followed me about 300 yards, and finding he could not catch me, returned. I proceeded to Lexington through Mystic and alarmed Mr. Adams and Colonel Hancock, Paul Revere. These are men that are willing to stand up. And to say stand up, I will play again Jeremy Dodge, his song, Stand Up.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Open your mouth from sea to shining sea. So will the real Americans. Please stand up. No more hiding your face in the sand. Will the real Americans.
I think it's time we ask ourselves if we still know the freedoms that were intended for us by the founding fathers.
Boom, it rise. When politicians take from you and me the very liberties that set us free. Stand up and fight. For this democracy is you and me. We're the refounders, saddled up, let's ride. Now will the real Americans, please stand up. No more hiding your face in the sand. Will the real Americans please stand up?
inalienable rights are now considered to be a dispensation of government. And freedom has never been so fragile, so close to slipping from our grasp as it is at this moment.
I think it's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody just look going. Stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look at what's going. Stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look at what's going. Stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look at what's going. Yeah.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
All right, Jeremy Dodge. Now, I wasn't exactly sure, you know, how I was going to get through today's show, because those of you that listen to me know I usually have a guest and I usually have a co-host who I play off of. This is one of the very few times where it was just me, myself, and I, and thank you to those that were in the chat room and those that had called in and listened on the line. But there's so much more I wanted to get through. I did want to play, you know, JFK's 4th of July, you know, speech, as well as Ronald Reagan's, but we really are starting to run out of time. And I will think I'm going to finish off with Bibi Netanyahu. And he did an absolutely fantastic July 4th speech to not just the nation of Israel, but he also addressed the United States. And I think the show would not be complete if I failed to play this. So this is Bibi Netanyahu, July 4th, 2012, and I'm bringing it up right now, and it should look...
Ambassador Shapiro, Dan and Julie, President Peres, members of the Israeli government, members of the Knesset, distinguished diplomats, honored guests, and especially the members of the United States Armed Forces. You know, I'm really thrilled each year to see those wonderful drills that you do with the flags, and that's another reason I really wanted to be with you tonight. But I got hurt playing football. No, not the football with helmets, shoulder pads, and the funny-shaped ball. How do you throw that thing anyway? Well, I was playing a different kind of football, what Americans call soccer. Well, whatever they call it, it hurt, especially my pride. But I wanted to express my appreciation to you, Dan, for the wonderful job you're doing as America's ambassador to Israel. And Sarah and I also wanted to wish you and Julia mazal tov on the bat mitzvah of your daughter, Liat. Even though I can't be there in person, I wanted to express my appreciation to President Obama and to the American people as you celebrate Independence Day. You see, because as Israel's prime minister, I appreciate deeply all that America has done for Israel. And as the leader of one of the world's most vibrant democracies, you know how vibrant, I appreciate all the great sacrifices that America has made in order to advance liberty and democracy throughout the world. America's revolution was founded on two very powerful ideas, that people should have the right to elect their own leaders and be sovereign over their own destiny. And second, that the power of those leaders, the power of governments, must be checked so that individual rights will be protected. I'm always moved, no matter how many years pass, I'm always moved when I read Thomas Jefferson's words. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Precisely. The American Revolution brought these two powerful ideas together, and they made America a beacon of liberty for all humanity. Now, you know that the Middle East is undergoing a profound and historic transformation. And the question arises, will these twin ideas, will they become rooted in our region too? All those who value freedom should remember that to be a real democracy, it's not enough to have a government that represents the majority of the people. Real democracy also means having a government that respects the rights of each and every individual in it, Real democracy is not merely about holding popular elections. It's about what happens between elections. It means ensuring that no one is above the law. It means protecting free speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion. It means upholding the rights of women, minorities, gays, children, everyone. By ensuring both popular sovereignty and individual rights, the nations of the region can join America and Israel in being genuine democracies. Now, will this happen? In the near term, I think we'll all agree there's ample reason for skepticism. The forces currently throughout the region that are rising are not exactly, how shall I put it, they're not exactly Jeffersonians. But in the long term, I believe there's reason for hope. Because with the spread of information technology, it will become increasingly difficult to keep young minds closed, cloistered in darkness. Ultimately, the power of freedom is bound to prevail. Ultimately, people throughout the Middle East will enjoy the rights that we in free societies too often take for granted. Ladies and gentlemen, July 4th is a time to not take freedom for granted. It's a time to be thankful that history granted America the power to match its ideals with action. It's a time for free people everywhere to send their best wishes to the United States of America, the country that has done so much to make the world a safer, freer, and more peaceful place. So on behalf of the people of Israel, let me wish President Obama and all the American people a happy Independence Day, or as they say in small towns across America, Chag Sameach.
I don't think I could have said anything more powerful than he did. He took 4 minutes and 45 seconds to say what should be on the hearts of every solid American. So, on this 4th of July, I wish you all a safe holiday. And I wish and I pray that you keep in your hearts the words of the Declaration of Independence and pledge your life, your fortune, and your sacred honor to the American people. Good night and God bless.